Views expressed on the following program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. This is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Good morning, and welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Welcome to an Hour of Mind Power. I'm Donna Sebo, and this next hour is a special Christmas broadcast for your listening pleasure. So I invite you to sit back, relax, and enjoy. Is there a Santa Claus? This is a story from the editorial page of the New York Sun, and it was written by the late Mr. Frank P. Church. We take pleasure in answering at once, and thus prominently, the communication below, expressing at the same time our great gratification that its faithful author is numbered among the friends of the Sun. Dear Editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says, if you see it in the sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus? Virginia O'Hanlon. Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant, in his intellect as compared with the boundless world around him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole of truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. And you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus! It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith in, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The external light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus? You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch in all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus. But even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not. But that's no proof that they are not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders there are unseen and unseeable in the world. You may tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the whole noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, nor even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernatural beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus? Thank God. He lives and he lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood.
Oh,
Rocking around the Christmas tree, a tradition so many of us enjoy. Do you know the legend or information about the Christmas tree? Well, here it is. The Christmas tree, like the maypole, originated ultimately in pre-Christian Europe, where northern peoples believed that trees, fruit trees and evergreens in particular, were embodiments of powerful beings. This connection to paganism is distant, however, and the more immediate link is to the Middle Ages. In the 14th and 15th centuries, Philip V. Snyder notes, the designated miracle play for December 24th was the story of Adam and Eve. And in this play, the chief prop was an apple-hung evergreen called the Paradise Tree, dramatically evoking for the illiterate medieval audiences the lost innocence of Eden. Perhaps as an invitation to that innocence, perhaps as a throwback to their pagan heritage, German families in the 16th century began bringing evergreens into their homes during the holiday season. By the 17th century, these were known as Christbaum, Christ trees, and were being decorated with fruit, candies, fruits, and flat wafers resembling the Eucharist host. The candles that were the precursors of our Christmas lights were introduced at about the same time, although a pretty but unsubstantiated legend said they were invented earlier by Martin Luther. The Christbaum remained largely a German custom until the 19th century, when it was taken to England by German merchants and popularized by Victoria's beloved consort Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg. The first Christmas trees in America were set up by German immigrants in the 1820s, although it was many decades before the custom took firm hold. As late as 1878, according to Snyder, one New York reporter referred to the import as an aboriginal oddity. The almost universal adoption of the custom, Snyder says, dates from the 1910s. Elvis, I love you. Forget the blue Christmas stuff. No, it's red and green. Why red and green? Well, it's the dominant color scheme of the holiday season, and it reflects the ancient popularity of holly among both the Britons and the Romans. Yes, this is old history. Holly, like other evergreens, was commonly used as winter decoration in the hope that the plant's remarkable ability to survive throughout the death of winter would lend a similar strength to people's homes. Now, during Roman Saturnalia, buried holly was placed in windows. Now, Mr. T.G. Crippen suggests it was an offer of hospitality to the spirits of the then-denuded woods, and the second-century Christian writer Tertullian complained that his fellow religionists did the same. Whatever the reason the custom was originally adopted, it proved easily assimilable into Christian iconography for two reasons. First, the holly bush could be, and was, likened to the burning bush of the Old Testament. Second, with its prickles and blood-red berries, the plant was tailor-made emblem of the crown of thorns that Jesus would eventually wear. The green and red poinsettia, native to Central America, has been a Christmas symbol in the United States since the 1820s, when it was first shipped north by Joel Poinsett, the American minister, to Mexico. Its shape is frequently compared to the mythically symmetrical Star of Bethlehem. Christmas wasn't always a tradition appreciated and enjoyed by the majority. No, history tells another story of the journey Christmas has taken into what we enjoy today. This is from Customs and Fashions in Old New England. And this was written in 1903, and this is about colonial Christmases. And Alice Morse Earle is the woman that put this article together. The first century of colonial life saw few set times and days for pleasure. The holy days of the English church were as stench to the Puritan nostrils, and their public celebration was at once rigidly forbidden by the laws of New England. New holidays were not quickly evolved, and the sober gatherings for matters of church and state for a time took their place. The hatred of wanton, bacchanalian Christmases spent throughout England, as Cotton said, in reveling, dicing, carding, masking, mumming, consumed in compotations, in interludes, in excessive wine, in mad mirth, was the natural reaction of intelligent and thoughtful minds against the excesses of a festival which had ceased to be a Christian holiday, but was dominated by a lord of misrule who did not hesitate to invade the churches in time of service in his noisy revels and sports. English churchmen long ago revolted against such Christmas observance. Of the first pilgrim Christmases we know, but very little, save that it was spent, as was many a later one, in work. By 1659, the Puritans had grown to hate Christmas more and more. It was, to use Shakespeare's words, the bug that feared them all. The very name smacked to them of incense, stole, and monkish jargon. Any person who observed it as a holiday by forbearing of labor, feasting, or any other way, was to pay 5 shillings fine. So desirous were they to beat down every sprout of episcopacy. Judge Sewall watched jealously the feeling of the people with regard to Christmas, and noted with pleasure on each succeeding year the continuance of common traffic throughout the day. Such entries as this show his attitude. December 25, 1685. Carts come to town, and shops open as usual. But somehow observe the day, I am vexed. I believe that the body of people profane it, and blessed be God. No authority yet to compel them to keep it. When the Church of England established Christmas services in Boston a few years later, we find the judge waging hopeless war against Governor Belcher over it, and hear him praising his son for not going with other boys to hear the novel and attractive services. He says, "I dehort mine from Christmas keeping and charge them to forbear." Christmas could not be regarded till this century as a New England holiday, though in certain localities such as Old Narragansett, an opulent community which was settled by Episcopalians, 2 weeks of Christmas visiting and feasting were entered into with zest by both planters and slaves for many years previous to the Revolution. Thank goodness for change.
The wind may not blow, might not even snow, but there's nothing like Christmas right here at home. Not be white, might be a rainy night, but there's nothing like sharing the sounds and the sights of Christmas in the Northwest. It's a gift that we can share. Christmas in the Northwest is a child.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Disasters like Hurricane Katrina or a fire can happen anytime. Do you have records of household items, business inventory, or special collections that need to be documented and photographed? If not, you're going to need to know about two very special ladies, Gail and Lori. This mother and daughter team come to your home or business and provide you with a digital, photographic record of household, business, or other important items. Their business? Camera Capers. It's a specialized digital photography company. This digital inventory can be used for estate planning, insurance purposes, or just for personal record keeping. Why don't you protect yourself and your belongings by having Camera Capers provide you with a photographic CD and itemized inventory list that you can keep in a safe place when you need it. Call Camera Capers today at 425-640-9263 or email cameracapers@acninc.net for more information. Gail or Lori will be happy to provide a private consultation for your particular needs. Contact Camera Capers today, 425-640-9263 or cameracapers@acninc.net. You'll be glad you did. The Fir Tree by Hans Christian Andersen. Out in the forest stood a pretty little fir tree. It had a good place. It could have sunlight. Air there was in plenty, and all around grew many larger comrades, pines as well as firs. But the little fir tree wished ardently to become greater. It did not care for the warm sun and the fresh air. It took no notice of the peasant children who went about talking together when they had come out to look for strawberries and raspberries. Often they came with a whole potful, or had strung berries on a straw. Then the children would sit down by the little fir tree and say, "How pretty and small that one is!" And the tree did not like to hear that at all. Next year he had grown a great joint, and the following year he was longer still, for in fir trees one can always tell by the number of rings they have by how many years they have been growing. "Oh, if only I were as great a tree as the others," sighed the little fir. "Then I would spread my branches far round and look out from my crown into the wide world. The birds would then build nests in my boughs, and when the wind blew I could just nod grandly as the others yonder." He took no pleasure in the sunshine, in the birds, and in the red clouds that went sailing over him morning and evening. When it was winter, and the snow lay all around, white and sparkling, a hare would often come jumping along and spring right over the little fir tree. Oh, this made him so angry! But two winters went by, and when the third came, the little tree had grown so tall that the hare was obliged to run around it. "Oh, to grow and become old, that's the only fine thing in the world," thought the tree. In the autumn woodcutters always came and felled a few of the largest trees. That was done this year, too, and the little fir tree that was now quite well grown shuddered with fear, for the great stately trees fell to the ground with a crash, and their branches were cut off, so that the trees looked quite naked, long and slender. They could hardly be recognized. But then they were laid upon wagons, and horses dragged them away, away out of the wood. Where were they going? What destiny awaited them? In the spring, when the swallows and the stork came, the tree asked them, "Do you know where they were taken? Did you not meet them?" The swallows knew nothing about it, but the stork looked thoughtful, nodded his head, and said,
"Yes, I think so. I met many new ships when I flew out of Egypt. On the ships were stately masts. I fancy that these were the trees. They smelt like fir. I can assure you they are stately, very stately."
"Oh, that I were only big enough to go over the sea. What kind of thing is this sea, and how does it look?"
"It would take too long to explain all that," said the stork, and he went away.
"Rejoice in thy youth," said the sunbeams. "Rejoice in thy fresh growth and in the young life that is within thee." And the wind kissed the tree, and the dew wept tears upon it. But the fir tree did not understand that. When Christmas time approached, quite young trees were felled, sometimes trees which were neither so old nor so large as this fir tree, that never rested but always wanted to go away. These young trees, which were almost the most beautiful, kept all their branches. They were put upon wagons, and their horses dragged them away out of the wood.
"Where are they all going?" asked the fir.
"They are not greater than I. Indeed, one of them was much smaller. Why do they keep all their branches? Whither are they taken?"
"We know that, we know that," chirped the sparrows. "Yonder in the town we looked in at the windows. We know where they go. Oh, they're all dressed up in the greatest pomp and splendor that can be imagined. We've looked in at the windows, and have perceived that they're planted in the middle of the warm room, and adorned with the most beautiful things, gilt apples, honey cakes, playthings, and many hundreds of candles."
"And then?" asked the fir tree, and trembled through all the branches. "And then? What happened then?"
"Why, we have not seen anything more, but it was incomparable."
"Perhaps I may be destined to tread this glorious path one day," cried the fir tree rejoicingly.
"That is even better than traveling across the sea. How painfully I long for it. If it were only Christmas now. Now I am great and grown up like the rest who were led away last year. Oh, if I were only on the carriage. If I were only in the warm room among all the pomp and splendor. And then, yes, then something even better will come, something far more charming, or else why should they adorn me so? There must be something grander, something greater still to come, but what? Oh, I'm suffering, I'm longing, I don't know myself, what is the matter with me?"
"Rejoice in us," said Air and Sunshine, "rejoice in thy fresh youth here in the woodland." But the fir tree did not rejoice at all, but it grew and grew. Winter and summer it stood there, green, dark green. The people who saw it said, "That's a handsome tree." And at Christmas time it was felled before any one of the others. The axe cut deep into its marrow, and the tree fell to the ground with a sigh. It felt a pain, a sensation of faintness, and could not think at all of happiness, for it was sad at parting from its home, from the place where it had grown up. It knew that it should never see again the dear old companions, the little bushes and flowers all around, perhaps not even the birds. The parting was not at all agreeable. The tree only came to itself when it was unloaded in a yard with other trees, and heard a man say,
"This one is famous. We only want this one."
Now, two servants came in gay liveries, and carried the fir tree into a large, beautiful salon. All around the walls hung pictures, and by the great stove stood large Chinese vases with lions on the covers. There were rocking chairs, silken sofas, great tables covered with picture books, and toys worth 100 times $100. At least the children said so. And the fir tree was put into a great tub filled with sand. But no one could see that it was a tub, for it was hung round with green cloth, and stood on a large, many-colored carpet. Oh, how the tree trembled! What was to happen now? The servants and young ladies also decked it out. On one branch they hung little nets cut out of colored paper. Every net was filled with sweetmeats. Golden apples and walnuts hung down as if they grew there, and more than 100 little candles, red, white, and blue, were fastened to the different boughs. Dolls that looked exactly like real people, the tree had never seen such before, swung among the foliage, and high on the summit of the tree was fixed a tinsel star. It was splendid. Particularly splendid. "This evening," said all, "this evening it will shine." "Oh," thought the tree, "that it were evening already. Oh, that the lights may soon be lit up. What may that it be done? I wonder if the tree will come out of the forest to look at me. Will the sparrows fly against the panes? Shall I grow fast here, and stand adorned in summer and winter?" Yes, but he did not guess badly. But he had a complete backache from mere longing, and the backache is just as bad for a tree as the headache for a person. At last the candles were lighted. What a brilliance, what splendor! The tree trembled so in all its branches that one of the candles set fire to a green twig, and it was scorched. "Heaven preserve us!" cried the young ladies, and they hastily put the fire out. Now the tree might not even tremble. Oh, that was terrible! It was so afraid of setting fire to some of its ornaments, and it was quite bewildered with all the brilliance. And now the folding doors were thrown open, and a number of children rushed in as they would have overturned the whole tree. The older people followed more deliberately. The little ones stood quite silent, but only for a minute. Then they shouted till the room rang. They danced gleefully round the tree, and one present after another was plucked from it. "What are they about?" laughed the tree. "What's going to be done?" And the candles burned down to the twigs, and as they burned down they were extinguished, and then the children received permission to plunder the tree. Oh, they rushed in upon it, so that every branch cracked again. If it had not been fastened by the top and by the golden star to the ceiling, it surely would have fallen down. The children danced around with the pretty toys. No one looked at the tree except one old man, who came up and peeped among the branches, but only to see if a fig or an apple had been forgotten. "A story, a story!" shouted the children, and they drew a little fat man towards the tree, and he sat down just beneath it. "For then we shall be in the green wood," said he, "and the tree may have the advantage of listening to my tale, but I can only tell one. Will you hear the story of Avinid, or Avidi, or of Clumpty Dumpty, who fell down the stairs, and still was raised up to honor and married the princes?" "Avidi, Avidi," cried some. "Clumpty Dumpty," cried the others, and there was a great crying and shouting. Only the fir tree was quite silent and thought, "Shall I not be in it? Shall I have nothing to do in it?" But he had been in the evening's amusement, and had done what was required of him. And the fat man told about Clumpty Dumpty, who fell down the stairs, and yet was raised to honor and married the princes. And the children clapped their hands and cried, "Tell another, tell another," for they wanted to hear about Avidi, Avidi. But they only got the story of Clumpty Dumpty. The fir tree stood quite silent and thoughtful. Never had the birds in the wood told such a story as that. Clumpty Dumpty fell down the stairs, and yet came to honor and married the princes. Yes, so it happens in the world, thought the fir tree, and believed it must be true, because that was such a nice man who told it. Well, who can know? Perhaps I shall fall downstairs, too, and marry a princess. And it looked forward with pleasure to being adorned again the next evening, with candles and toys, gold and fruit. Tomorrow I shall not tremble, it thought. I will rejoice in all my splendor. Tomorrow I shall hear the story of Clumpty Dumpty again, and perhaps that of Avidi, Avidi too. And the tree stood all night quiet and thoughtful. In the morning the servants and the chambermaid came in. "Now my splendor will begin afresh," thought the tree. But they dragged him out of the room and up the stairs to the garret, and here they put him in a dark corner where no daylight shone. "What's the meaning of this?" thought the tree. "What am I to do here? What is to happen?" And he leaned against the wall and thought and thought. And he had time enough, for days and nights went by and nobody came up. And when at length someone did come, it was only to put some boxes in a corner. Now the tree stood quite hidden away, and the supposition was that it was quite forgotten. "Now it's winter outside," thought the tree. "The earth is hard and covered with snow, and people cannot plant me. Therefore, I suppose I'm to be sheltered here until spring comes. How considerate that is! How good people are! If it were only not so dark here and so terribly solitary, not even a little hare." That was pretty out there in the wood when the snow lay thick and the hare sprang past. Yes, even when he jumped over me, but then I did not like it. It is terribly lonely up here. "Peep, peep," said a little mouse, and crept forward. And then came another little one. They smelt at the fir tree, and then slipped along the branches. "It's awfully cold," said the two little mice, "or else it would be comfortable here. Don't you think so, you old fir tree?" "I'm not old at all," said the fir tree. "There are many much older than I." "Where do you come from?" asked the mice. "And what do you know?" They were dreadfully inquisitive. "Tell us about the most beautiful spot on earth. Have you been there? Have you been in the storeroom where cheeses lie on the shelves?
and hams hang from the ceiling, where one dances on tallow candles and goes in thin and comes out fat?"
"I don't know that," replied the tree, "but I know the wood where the sun shines and where the birds sing." And then it told all about its youth. And the little mice had never heard anything of the kind, and they listened and said,
"What a number of things you have seen! How happy you must be!"
"I?" said the fir tree, and it thought about what it had been told.
Yes, those were really quite happy times. But then he told of the Christmas tree, when he had been hung with sweetmeats and candles.
"Oh," said the little mice, "how happy you've been, you old fir tree!"
"I'm not old at all," said the tree. "I only came out of the wood this winter. I'm only rather backward in my growth."
"What splendid stories you can tell," said the little mice.
And the next night they came with four other little mice to hear what the tree had to relate. And the more it said, the more clearly did it remember everything and thought.
Those were quite merry days, but they may come again.
Klumpy Dumpy fell downstairs, and yet he married the princess. Perhaps I may marry a princess, too. And then the fir tree thought of a pretty little birch tree that grew out in the forest. For the fir tree, that birch was a real princess.
"Who's Klumpy Dumpy?" asked the little mice.
And then the fir tree told the whole story.
It could remember every single word, and the little mice were ready to leap to the very top of the tree with pleasure. Next night a great many more mice came, and on Sunday two rats even appeared. But these thought the story was not very pretty, and the little mice were sorry for that, for they now also did not like it so much as before.
"Do you only know one story?"
asked the rats.
"Only that one," replied the tree. "I heard that on the happiest evening of my life. I did not think then how happy I was."
"That's a very miserable story. Don't you know any about bacon and tallow candles, a storeroom story?"
"No," said the tree.
"Then we'd rather not hear you," said the rats.
And they went back to their own people. The little mice at last stayed away also, and then the tree sighed and said,
"It was very nice when they sat around me, the merry little mice, and listened when I spoke to them. Now that's past too. But I shall remember to be pleased when they take me out."
But when did that happen? Why, it was one morning the people came and rummaged in the garret. The boxes were put away and the tree brought out. They certainly threw him rather roughly on the floor, but a servant dragged him away at once to the stairs where the daylight shone.
"Now life is beginning again," thought the tree. It felt the fresh air and the first sunbeams, and now it was out in the courtyard. Everything passed so quickly that the tree quite forgot to look at itself. There was so much to look at all around. The courtyard was close to a garden, and here everything was blooming. The roses hung fresh and fragrant over the little paling. The linden trees were in blossom, and the swallows cried,
"Whizzit! Whizzit! My husband's gone by."
But it was not the fir tree that they meant.
"Now I shall live," said the tree rejoicingly, and spread its branches far out. But alas! They were all withered and yellow, and it lay in the corner among nettles and weeds. The tinsel star was still upon it, and shone in the bright sunshine. In the courtyard a couple of the merry children were playing, who had danced around the tree at Christmas time, and had rejoiced over it. One of the youngest ran up and tore off the golden star.
"Look at what is sticking to the ugly old fir tree," said the child,
and he trod upon the branches till they cracked again under his boots. And the tree looked at all the blooming flowers and the splendor of the garden, and then looked at itself and wished it had remained in the dark corner of the garret. It thought of its fresh youth in the wood, of the merry Christmas Eve, and of the little mice which had listened so pleasantly to the story of Klumpy Dumpy.
"Pass, pass," said the old tree, "had I but rejoiced when I could have done so. Pass, pass." And the servant came and chopped the tree into little pieces. A whole bundle lay there. It blazed brightly under the great brewing copper, and it sighed deeply, and each sigh was like a little shot. And the children who were at play there ran up and seated themselves at the fire, looked into it, and cried, "Puff, puff!" But at each explosion, which was a deep sigh, the tree thought of a summer day in the woods, or of a winter night there when the stars beamed.
He thought of Christmas Eve and of Klumpy Dumpy, the only story he had ever heard, or knew how to tell, and then the tree was burned. The boys played in the garden, and the youngest had on his breast a golden star, which the tree had worn on its happiest evening. Now that was past, and the tree's life was past. And the story is past, too. Past, past. And that's the way with all stories.
All right, you chipmunks. Ready to sing your song?
I'll say we are. Yeah, let's sing it now.
Okay, Simon?
Okay.
Okay, Theodore?
Okay.
Okay, Alvin? Alvin? Alvin!
No time to cook or go out? Check out www.delicious-planet.com. We deliver the healthy, deliciously prepared salads, chicken, fish, and fresh vegetables that you crave. Delicious Planet uses organic ingredients in all of their nutritionally balanced dishes. If you are into staying fit, eating healthy, and enjoying fresh, real food, you deserve Delicious Planet. Visit us online at delicious-planet.com.
Throughout the month of December, you can help improve Alternative Talk 1150 AM by logging on to 1150kknw.com and filling out the simple listener survey. Your thoughts are very valuable to us. So log on to 1150kknw.com and click on the survey link at the top of the page. As thanks for your efforts, Alternative Talk 1150 AM will enter you into a drawing for $300 worth of gift certificates for Tony Roma's. Now that's a lot of ribs. Log on to 1150kknw.com today and let your thoughts be heard. Remember, that's 1150kknw.com.
The Donna Sebo Show has an opening for an energetic radio sales professional. Radio is a great way to reach thousands of people. If you have experience in selling media advertising, the Donna Sebo Show might provide you with a great opportunity. In this position, an independently contracted sales rep could reap direct financial rewards from efforts on behalf of the show. Contact Donna today at 253-582-5604 or email at donna@delphiinternational.com.
Bushels of fun. Now the jingle hop has begun. Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell.
Leo Bascaglio was an internationally loved teacher, writer, and lecturer. And he wrote a book, Seven Stories of Christmas Love. And I'm going to share one of those stories. This is his story about the gift of ravioli. When Leo was a child, he had a crush on a librarian. He said once a week she held a story hour in the garden of their neighborhood library. She read to the kids wonderful tales of adventure, fantasy, and beauty. I was never absent from these sessions. In fact, I would often arrive hours early to assure myself a seat in the front row so as not to miss a single word. I remember vividly the Christmas when she read Henry Van Dyke's The Story of the Other Wise Man. I was only 8 or 9 years old. Usually she read many stories in the allotted hour, but on this occasion she read only one. After the reading was over, she hugged us all a Merry Christmas. She took me by the hand and walked me outside through the library. She knelt down beside me and smiled. I've got a Christmas present for you, Leo. I want to give you the book I've just read. She handed me her copy of The Story of the Other Wise Man. Did you enjoy the story? She asked. Frankly, I didn't understand it, but of course I wasn't going to tell her that. Instead, I said, yes, it was really interesting. In actuality, the story had confused me. I couldn't imagine that anyone would be so insane as to give up for any reason being present in Bethlehem for the birth of Jesus of Nazareth. Nor could I understand that a person would give rubies and pearls, intended for Christ's birthday, present to cruel soldiers and conniving debt collectors. I recall that I went straight home, clutching the little book in my hand, determined to read it once more. Surely if my wonderful friend loved the book, I would too. As many know, the story tells of the magical voyage of the three wise men of the East, how they traveled from the far, guided by a single star to bear gifts to a newborn king who was lying in a manger in Bethlehem. But it suggests that there was a fourth wise man, of whom I'd never heard, who also saw a star in the East and set off on the long, arduous journey to join the other wise men bearing his precious gifts. According to the story, the three wise men had no trouble getting to Bethlehem, but the fourth, Artaban, had nothing but problems. First, he meets a sick Hebrew, exile, alone and dying in the desert. Overcome with pity, he stops and ministers to the sick man. This delay causes him to miss his rendezvous with the other wise men, and as a result, he misses being present in the manger on that magical first Christmas. Still, he travels on. Not long afterward, he gives away one of the gifts intended for the newborn child in order to save the life of another infant who, by Herod's decree, had been condemned to die. Time after time, he stops to minister to the sick, comfort the oppressed and imprisoned, and feed the hungry. As the story ends, Artaban is despairing and very tired. He realizes that he's been on his search for 33 years, ending by finding himself in Golgotha. Here he discovers that the Son of God, whom he had so many years ago set out to find, had been condemned to die on the cross. He immediately thinks of his very last possession, a pearl. He feels certain that this will buy Christ's freedom, but even on his way to try to bargain for Christ's life, he encounters a woman who is being threatened with assault and murder in payment for her father's debt. Again, he offers the pearl, his final possession, as ransom for her life. Now, truly, he has nothing. All that he had intended to give in worship, he had given in the service of humanity. To add to his trials, Artaban is struck by a stone from a falling structure, caused by an earthquake that accompanied the crucifixion. He is certain now that he will die without ever seeing his Lord. But as he lies bleeding and dying, he hears a faint voice from far off. Verily I say unto thee, inasmuch as thou hast done unto one of the least of my brethren, thou hast done unto me. Hearing this, Artaban, the fourth wise man, dies with the happy knowledge that his gifts were received by his Lord. At last I understood. While at first I had thought the wise man to be not so wise at all for missing his chance to witness the first Christmas, for giving away all his possessions, for having spent his entire life ministering to others, it all became clear to me. Artaban was certainly the wisest and most worthy of all the wise men. I couldn't wait to tell the story to Mama and Papa. They had brought with them a tradition of storytelling and listened intently. When I finished, they looked at each other for some time in silence. Then Mama spoke. "It's the nicest story, Felix," she said, "and it's true. When you give away you have it to help of someone else, it is like a giving it to God." Papa asked, "What are you going to give her tonight, the library lady?" "Gee," I thought, "I don't have anything to give her." "I know," Mama said. "I'll make her a nice dish of ravioli." "Ravioli!" I shouted. I was certain my precious friend, who had just presented me with such a sophisticated gift, would scoff at Mama's ravioli. I wanted to give her rubies, frankincense, or at least myrrh, whatever that was. As usual, my protestations carried little weight, and I was soon on my way to the library with a dish full of handmade ravioli and a jar of rich red sauce, both wrapped securely in brown paper bags. On the way, I contemplated all the ways in which I could dispose of the gift. They would never know. I considered dropping it into a drain, throwing it behind the food market, or dumping it into a trash can. But conscience prevailed and propelled me into the library. There I discovered my love seated behind the checkout desk. "Leo," she greeted me warmly as I entered. "I brought you a present," I explained, extending the bags at arm's length. It's kind of dumb," I stammered. It's something to eat for later." She eagerly took the package and peered into the brown bag, holding the ravioli dish. Her eyes lit up brightly. "Ravioli!" she exclaimed. "Oh, I love ravioli! Thank you. It's not a dumb gift at all. It's a real treasure, more precious than jewels." "More precious than jewels?" I thought. "Yes, of course! I finally and truly understood the story of the other wise man. Mama's ravioli took on a very special meaning." Thank you, Leo.
Thank you.
This next story is my award-winning children's audio book, God's Kiss.
A small white country chapel with a tall wooden steeple is filled with the sounds of Christmas music. It stands with dignity, covered with freshly fallen snow. The strains of Silent Night float from the little church. It is Christmas Eve, and snow is beginning to fall once again. The effects are magical. In the darkness, the last chords of Silent Night fade softly, their echoes muffled by the falling snow. The little church stands quietly, the soft glow of its light spilling a message of peace and warmth through its stained glass windows. Johnny, Johnny, wake up. It's late. A hand gently shakes the shoulder of a little boy who, during the church service, has fallen sound asleep. Johnny awakens reluctantly. He has had a special dream, and he doesn't want to leave its happiness and serenity, but he has no choice. Getting up slowly out of the church pew, he sleepily stands still while his mother bundles him up in a cherry red jacket and hood to protect him against the cold outside. Come on, Johnny, let's go home, says his mother. Placing his hand in his mother's, Johnny walks out to the car, stumbling now and then as he is still half asleep. When they arrive at the car, Johnny leans against his mother's leg, hardly able to keep his eyes open. He feels strong arms surround him and lift him up, placing him on the back seat.
Little Turk sure was good tonight, Mrs. Leslie. It's usually pretty hard for a little un like that to make it through an evening of church without fussing.
Yes, he was unusually good, Adam. Thank you for putting him in the car for me.
Sure, any time. He's no small sack of potatoes, that boy. Have a nice Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Adam. Good night. Mrs. Leslie gets into her car and starts the long drive home through the snow. It will be at least an hour before they'll be there. A white Christmas, Johnny will be so pleased. She smiles happily to herself as she thinks of the new sled she has gotten for Johnny, knowing how thrilled he will be trying it out Christmas morning. Johnny, meanwhile, curled up and sleeping on the back seat, is totally unaware of all that has gone on about him. He has re-entered his dream world and is now living an adventure which he will always call God's Christmas Kiss. Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley framed by high mountains rich in the brown-red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
Well, why are you standing there, Johnny? Go into the valley!
Johnny is startled. He can't imagine who spoke. There is no one around.
Craw! Craw! Time to Langston! Move along! Move along!
Looking about, Johnny notices a super-sized crow nervously flapping its wings. Did you just speak to me? Asked the amazed Johnny.
Of course I did. What do you think I am? A mute? Children.
The crow sounds very disgusted. Gee, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. Just never had a crow talk to me before, says Johnny quietly.
Oh, of course you have,
says the crow.
You just never listened. Oh, no matter. Just hurry and enter the Valley of the Animals. For tonight, there is to be a special gathering, and you are one of the last to arrive. Hurry, hurry, follow me.
With these words, the crow begins to flap his wings vigorously, rising high into the air, then dips down, just in front of Johnny.
Follow me,
he calls.
Follow me.
Johnny follows as he is told. It is all he can do to keep up with the fast, flying crow. He falls once, but hardly pays attention. He isn't concerned over anything but reaching that special destination. While Johnny is so intent on following Crow, he fails to notice the family of gray bunnies that watch his actions from their burrow beneath a tall green pine.
Goodness, there's always one that's late. We'd best be getting along, too.
Gently prodding her six babies with her pink nose, Mama Bunny proceeds to lead her family to the destination, taking their own special shortcut to be there in prime time. Johnny feels like he's been following Crow for such a long time when suddenly he hears,
Take your place! Take your place in the circle!
Stopping in amazement, Johnny looks upon a scene he never could have imagined. He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying. Noticing Johnny's arrival, the animals and children greet him.
Hi, Johnny. We've been waiting for you. Here, come take your place in the circle.
Everyone is filled with such joy and happiness. A unique feeling of expectancy fills the air, and Johnny's curiosity is aroused. Close to Johnny is a little skunk, who is talking excitedly to a green and black snake coiled up next to him.
This is my first time. Have you felt God's kiss before?
Little skunk asks the gentle snake.
Oh, yes,
says gentle snake.
But each time it is so special, you can never describe it. You just have to feel it.
Oh, I can hardly wait,
says little skunk.
Excuse me, but what is God's kiss?
Asked Johnny.
And why is this night so special? Why do all the animals talk? I don't understand.
Questions come tumbling one after another from Johnny's mouth. The gentle snake looks at little skunk and says,
He's a new one. We should explain.
Gentle snake slides over to Johnny.
I will tell you.
Quickly back to his place in the circle, Gentle Snake coils himself into a comfortable position, patiently waiting.
Silence!
A voice thunders. Following the sound's direction, Johnny realizes that a large golden cat has given the order. Everything and everyone becomes still as still can be. Johnny notices the beauty of the valley and the wondrous array of animals he has never seen before. The atmosphere is so peaceful. Whenever so gently and quietly, a golden light begins to fill the valley. It becomes stronger and stronger in intensity and color. It covers and illuminates individually every form of life that is gathered here in the valley. Johnny feels its warmth of love and peace surround him in a way only he could know and understand. The light pulsates, and Johnny is wishing he could stay within its form forever. Then, the light starts to slowly withdraw itself from all in the valley until the sky above can be clearly seen. The sky is bright with thousands of stars that sparkle in neon colors, reds, blues, greens, and yellows. Not one word is whispered, but anticipation fills each who waits. Small white flakes begin to fall. One falls on little skunk's nose.
I've been given God's kiss, he exclaims.
Everyone lifts their faces to receive God's kiss. Johnny whispers to himself as two snowflakes fall on his face, one on each cheek.
I've been kissed twice. God has kissed me twice.
He watches the other children and animals. He sees all of them given God's kiss. The earth, trees, and all forms of life are kissed, not one forgotten. Johnny's mother finally arrives home. The snow is coming down quite heavily now as she drives the car into the driveway. Her husband, seeing her arrive, quickly goes out to the car to help carry Johnny inside. Opening the car door, he reaches for Johnny, picks him up, and lifts him out.
Honey, this boy's in a deep sleep.
Yes, I know, dear. He is so very tired.
Johnny sleepily stirs in his father's arms, saying, God kissed me, Daddy. Of course he did, son, says his father. Of course he did. Smiling to himself, he takes the sleeping child into the house. While tucking his son into bed, Johnny's father turns to his wife and says, I don't know what Johnny is dreaming, but I sure wish I could share it with him. I'd like to close this Christmas program with a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Christmas Bells. I heard the bells on Christmas Day their old familiar carols play, and wild and sweet the words repeat of peace on earth, goodwill to men, and thought how, as the day had come, the belfries of all Christendom had rolled along the unbroken song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Till, ringing, swinging on its way, the world revolved from night to day, a voice, a chime, a chant sublime, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then from each black, accursed mouth, the cannon thundered in the south, and with the sound the carols drowned, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. It was as if an earthquake rent the hearthstones of a continent, and made forlorn the houses born of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
This program was organized and directed by Donna Sebo and production done by Benny Mathers.
Children, listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
Views expressed on the preceding program are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. This is Alternative Talk, 1150 KKNW, Seattle.